just about the most impressive thing that had been said all evening. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "let's give the general the biggest hand we've got." And there was applause immediately, and the young man indicated to Sally Poker with a motion of his thumb that she could take the old man back to his seat now so that the next person could be introduced. But the general had not finished. He stood immovable in the exact center of the spotlight, his neck thrust forward, his mouth slightly open, and his voracious gray eyes drinking in the glare and the applause. He elbowed his granddaughter roughly away. "I keep so young," he screeched. "I kiss all the pretty girls." This was met with a great din of spontaneous applause, and it was at just that instant that Sally Poker looked down at her feet and discovered that in the excitement of getting ready, she had forgotten to change her shoes. Two brown Girl Scout Oxfords protruded from the bottom of her dress. She gave the general a yank and almost ran with him off the stage. He was very angry that he had not got to say how glad he was to be here for this event, and on the way back to his seat, he kept saying as loud as he could, "I'm glad to be here at this preemie with all these beautiful girls." But there was another celebrity going up the other aisle, and nobody paid any attention to him. He slept through the picture, muttering fiercely every now and then in his sleep. Since then, his life had not been very interesting. His feet were completely dead now. His knees worked like old hinges. His kidneys functioned when they would, but his heart persisted doggedly to beat. The past and the future were the same thing to him, one forgotten and the other not remembered. He had no more notion of dying than a cat. Every year, on Confederate Memorial Day, he was bundled up and lent to the Capital City Museum, where he was displayed from 1 to 4 in a musty room full of old photographs, old uniforms, old artillery, and historic documents. All these were carefully preserved in glass cases, so that children would not put their hands on them. He wore his general's uniform from the premiere and sat with a fixed scowl inside a small roped area. There was nothing about him to indicate that he was alive, except an occasional movement in his milky gray eyes. But once, when a bold child touched his sword, his arm shot forward and slapped the hand off in an instant. In the spring, when the old homes were opened for pilgrimage, he was invited to wear his uniform and sit in some conspicuous spot and lend atmosphere to the scene. Some of these times he only snarled at the visitors, but sometimes he told about the premiere and the beautiful girls. If he had died before Sally Poker's graduation, she thought she would have died herself. At the beginning of the summer term, even before she knew if she would pass, she told the dean that her grandfather, General Tennessee Flint Rock Sash of the Confederacy, would attend her graduation, and that he was 104 years old and that his mind was still clear as a bell. Distinguished visitors were always welcome and could sit on the stage and be introduced. She made arrangements with her nephew, John Wesley Poker Sash, a Boy Scout, to come wheel the general's chair. She thought how sweet it would be to see the old man in his courageous gray and the young boy in his clean khaki. The old and the new, she thought appropriately. They would be behind her on the stage when she received her degree. Everything went almost exactly as she had planned. In the summer, while she was away at school, the general stayed with other relatives, and they brought him and John Wesley, the Boy Scout, down to the graduation. A reporter came to the hotel where they stayed and took the general's picture with Sally Poker on one side of him and John Wesley on the other. The general, who had had his picture taken with beautiful girls, didn't think much of this. He had forgotten precisely what kind of event this was he was going to attend, but he remembered that he was to wear his uniform and carry the sword. On the morning of the graduation, Sally Poker had to line up in the academic procession with the B.S.'s in elementary education, and she couldn't see to getting him on the stage herself. But John Wesley, a fat blonde boy of 10 with an executive expression, guaranteed to take care of everything. She came in her academic gown to the hotel and dressed the old man in his uniform. He was as frail as a dried spider. "Aren't you just thrilled, Papa?" she asked. "I'm just thrilled to death."
"Put that salt across my lap, damn you," the old man said. "Where it'll shine."
She put it there and then stood looking back at him. "You look just grand," she said.
"God damn it," the old man said in a slow, monotonous, certain tone,
as if he were saying it to the beating of his heart.
"God damn every goddamn thing to hell."
"Now, now," she said, and left happily to join the procession. The graduates were lined up behind the science building, and she found her place just as the line started to move. She had not slept much the night before, and when she had dreamed of the exercises, murmuring, "See him? See him?" in her sleep, but waking up every time just before she turned her head to look at him behind her. The graduates had to walk 3 blocks in the hot sun in their black wool robes, and as she plodded stolidly along, she thought that if anyone considered this academic procession something impressive to behold, they need only wait until they saw that old general in his courageous gray, and that clean young Boy Scout stoutly wheeling his chair across the stage with the sunlight catching the sword. She imagined that John Wesley had the old man ready now behind the stage. The black procession wound its way up the 2 blocks and started on the main walk leading to the auditorium. The visitors stood on the grass, picking out their graduates. Men were pushing back their hats and wiping their foreheads, and women were lifting their dresses slightly from the shoulders to keep them from sticking to their backs. The graduates in their heavy robes looked as if the last beads of ignorance were being sweated out of them. The sun blazed off the fenders of automobiles and beat from the columns of the buildings and pulled the eye from one spot of glare to another. It pulled Sally Poker's toward the big red Coca-Cola machine that had been set up by the side of the auditorium. Here she saw the general parked, scowling and hatless in his chair in the blazing sun, while John Wesley, his blouse loose behind, his hip and cheek pressed to the red machine, was drinking a Coca-Cola. She broke from the line and galloped to them and snatched the bottle away. She shook the boy and thrust in his blouse and put the hat on the old man's head. "Now get him in there," she said, pointing one rigid finger to the side door of the building. For his part, the general felt as if there were a little hole beginning to widen in the top of his head. The boy wheeled him rapidly down a walk and up a ramp and into a building, and bumped him over the stage entrance and into position, where he had been told, and the general glared in front of him at heads that all seemed to flow together and eyes that moved from one face to another. Several figures in black robes came and picked up his hand and shook it. A black procession was flowing up each aisle and forming to stately music in a pool in front of him. The music seemed to be entering his head through the little hole, and he thought for a second that the procession would try to enter it too. He didn't know what procession this was, but there was something familiar about it. It must be familiar to him since it had come to meet him, but he didn't like a black procession. Any procession that came to meet him, he thought irritably, ought to have floats with beautiful gulls on them like the floats before the preemie. It must be something connected with history like they were always having. He had no use for any of it. What happened then wasn't anything to a man living now, and he was living now. When all the procession had flowed into the black pool, a black figure began orating in front of it. The figure was telling something about history, and the general made up his mind he wouldn't listen. But the words kept seeping in through the little hole in his head. He heard his own name mentioned, and his chair was shuttled forward roughly, and the Boy Scout took a big bow.
They called his name, and the fat brat bowed.
"God damn you," the old man tried to say. "Get out of my way, I can stand up."
But he was jerked back again before he could get up and take the bow. He supposed the noise they made was for him. If he was over, he didn't intend to listen to any more of it. If it hadn't been for the little hole in the top of his head, none of the words would have got to him. He thought of putting his finger up there into the hole to block them, but the hole was a little wider than his finger, and it felt as if it were getting deeper. Another black robe had taken the place of the first one, and was talking now, and he heard his name mentioned again, but they were not talking about him. They were still talking about history.
"If we forget our past," the speaker was saying, "we won't remember our future, and it will be as well, for we won't have one."
The general heard some of these words gradually. He had forgotten history, and he didn't intend to remember it again. He had forgotten the name and face of his wife, and the names and faces of his children, or even if he had a wife and children. And he had forgotten the names of places, and the places themselves, and what had happened at them. He was considerably irked by the hole in his head. He had not expected to have a hole in his head at this event. It was the slow, black music that had put it there, and though most of the music had stopped outside, there was still a little of it in the hole, going deeper and moving around in his thoughts, letting the words he heard into the dark places of his brain. He heard the words Chickamauga, Shiloh, Johnston, Lee, and he knew he was inspiring all these words that meant nothing to him. He wondered if he had been a general at Chickamauga or at Lee. Then he tried to see himself and the horse, mounted in the middle of a float full of beautiful girls, being driven slowly through downtown Atlanta. Instead, the old words began to stir in his head, as if they were trying to wrench themselves out of place and come to life. The speaker was through with that war and had gone on to the next one, and now he was approaching another, and all his words, like the black procession, were vaguely familiar and irritating. There was a long finger of music in the general's head, probing various spots that were words, letting in a little light on the words, and helping them to live. The words began to come toward him, and he said, "Damn it, I ain't going to have it." And he started edging backwards to get out of the way. Then he saw the figure in the black robe sit down, and there was a noise, and the black pool in front of him began to rumble and to flow toward him, from either side to the black, slow music. And he said, "Stop, damn it! I can't do but one thing at a time." He couldn't protect himself from the words and attend to the procession, too, and the words were coming at him fast. He felt that he was running backwards, and the words were coming at him like musket fire, just escaping him, getting nearer and nearer. He turned around and began to run as fast as he could, but he found himself running toward the words. He was running into a regular volley of them and meeting them with quick curses. As the music swelled toward him, the entire past opened up on him out of nowhere, and he felt his body riddled in 100 places with sharp stabs of pain, and he fell down, returning a curse for every hit. He saw his wife's narrow face looking at him critically through her round gold-rimmed glasses. He saw one of his squinting, bald-headed sons, and his mother ran toward him with an anxious look. Then a succession of places, Chickamauga, Shiloh, Marthasville, rushed at him as if the past were the only future now, and he had to endure it. Then suddenly he saw that the black procession was almost on him. He recognized it, for it had been dogging all his days. He made such a desperate effort to see over it and find out what comes after the past that his hand clenched the sword until the blade touched bone. The graduates were crossing the stage in a long file to receive their scrolls and shake the president's hand. As Sally Poker, who was near the end, crossed, she glanced at the general and saw him sitting fixed and fierce, his eyes wide open. And she turned her head forward again and held it a perceptible degree higher and received her scroll. Once it was all over and she was out of the auditorium in the sun again, she located her kin. They waited together on a bench in the shade for John Wesley to wheel the old man out. That crafty scout had bumped him out the back way and rolled him at high speed down a flagstone path and was waiting now, with the corpse, in the long line at the Coca-Cola machine. Good Country People. Besides the neutral expression that she wore when she was alone, Mrs. Freeman had two others, forward and reverse, that she used for all her human dealings. Her forward expression was steady and driving like the advance of a heavy truck. Her eyes never swerved to left or right, but turned as the story turned, as if they followed a yellow line down the center of it. She seldom used the other expression because it was not often necessary for her to retract a statement, but when she did, her face came to a complete stop. There was an almost imperceptible movement of her black eyes, during which they seemed to be receding. And then the observer would see that Mrs. Freeman, though she might stand there as real as several grain sacks thrown on top of each other, was no longer there in spirit. As for getting anything across to her when this was the case, Mrs. Hopewell had given it up. She might talk her head off. Mrs. Freeman could never be brought to admit herself wrong on any point. She would stand there, and if she could be brought to say anything, it was something like, "Well, I wouldn't have said it was, and I wouldn't have said it wasn't." Or letting her gaze range over the top kitchen shelf, where there was an assortment of dusty bottles, she might remark, "I see you ain't ate many of them figs you put up last summer." They carried on their most important business in the kitchen at breakfast. Every morning, Mrs. Hopewell got up at 7 o'clock and lit her gas heater and Joy's. Joy was her daughter, a large blonde girl who had an artificial leg. Mrs. Hopewell thought of her as a child, though she was 32 years old and highly educated. Joy would get up while her mother was eating and lumber into the bathroom and slam the door, and before long Mrs. Freeman would arrive at the back door. Joy would hear her mother call, "Come on in," and then they would talk for a while in low voices that were indistinguishable in the bathroom. By the time Joy came in, they had usually finished the weather report and were on one or the other of Mrs. Freeman's daughters, Glenice or Caramay. Joy called them Glycerin and Caramel. Glenice, a redhead, was 18 and had many admirers. Caramay, a blonde, was only 15, but already married and pregnant. She could not keep anything on her stomach. Every morning Mrs. Freeman told Mrs. Hopewell how many times she had vomited since the last report. Mrs. Hopewell liked to tell people that Glenice and Caramay were two of the finest girls she knew, and that Mrs. Freeman was a lady, and that she was never ashamed to take her anywhere or introduce her to anybody they might meet. Then she would tell how she had happened to hire the Freemans in the first place, and how they were a godsend to her, and how she had had them for 4 years. The reason for her keeping them so long was that they were not trash. They were good country people. She had telephoned the man whose name they had given as a reference, and he had told her that Mr. Freeman was a good farmer, but that his wife was the nosiest woman ever to walk the earth. "She'd got to be into everything," the man said. "If she don't get there before the dust settles, you can bet she's dead, that's all. She'll want to know all your business. I can stand him real good," he had said. "But me nor my wife neither could have stood that woman one more minute on this place." That had put Mrs. Hopewell off for a few days. She had hired them in the end because there were no other applicants, but she had made up her mind beforehand exactly how she would handle the woman. Since she was the type who had to be into everything, then, Mrs. Hopewell had decided she would not only let her be into everything, she would see to it that she was into everything. She would give her the responsibility of everything. She would put her in charge.
Mrs. Hopewell had no bad qualities of her own, but she was able to use other people's in such a constructive way that she never felt the lack. She had hired the Freemans, and she had kept them 4 years. Nothing is perfect. This was one of Mrs. Hopewell's favorite sayings. Another was, "That is life." And still another, the most important, was, "Well, other people have their opinions, too." She would make these statements, usually at the table, in a tone of gentle insistence, as if no one held them but her. And the large, hulking Joy, whose constant outrage had obliterated every expression from her face, would stare just a little to the side of her, her eyes icy blue, with the look of someone who has achieved blindness by an act of will and means to keep it. When Mrs. Hopewell said to Mrs. Freeman that life was like that, Mrs. Freeman would say, "I always said so myself." Nothing had been arrived at by anyone that had not first been arrived at by her. She was quicker than Mr. Freeman. When Mrs. Hopewell said to her, after they had been on the place a while, "You know, you're the wheel behind the wheel," and winked, Mrs. Freeman had said, "I know it. I've always been quick. It's some that are quicker than others." "Everybody is different," Mrs. Hopewell said. "Yes, most people is," Mrs. Freeman said. "It takes all kinds to make the world. I always said it did myself." The girl was used to this kind of dialogue for breakfast, and more of it for dinner. Sometimes they had it for supper, too. When they had no guests, they ate in the kitchen because that was easier. Mrs. Freeman always managed to arrive at some point during the meal and to watch them finish it. She would stand in the doorway if it were summer, but in the winter she would stand with one elbow on top of the refrigerator and look down on them, or she would stand by the gas heater, lifting the back of her skirt slightly. Occasionally she would stand against the wall and roll her head from side to side. At no time was she in any hurry to leave. All this was very trying on Mrs. Hopewell, but she was a woman of great patience. She realized that nothing is perfect, and that in the Freemans she had good country people, and that if, in this day and age, you get good country people, you had better hang on to them. She had had plenty of experience with trash. Before the Freemans, she had averaged 1 tenant family a year. The wives of these farmers were not the kind you would want to be around you for very long. Mrs. Hopewell, who had divorced her husband long ago, needed someone to walk over the fields with her. And when Joy had to be impressed for these services, her remarks were usually so ugly and her face so glum that Mrs. Hopewell would say, "If you can't come pleasantly, I don't want you at all." To which the girl, standing square and rigid-shouldered with her neck thrust lightly forward, would reply, "If you want me, here I am. Like I am." Mrs. Hopewell excused this attitude because of the leg, which had been shot off in a hunting accident when Joy was 10. It was hard for Mrs. Hopewell to realize that her child was 32 now, and that for more than 20 years she had had only one leg. She thought of her still as a child, because it tore her heart to think instead of the poor stout girl in her 30s, who had never danced a step or had any normal good times. Her name was really Joy, but as soon as she was 21 and away from home, she had had it legally changed. Mrs. Hopewell was certain that she had thought and thought until she had hit upon the ugliest name in any language. Then she had gone and had the beautiful name Joy changed without telling her mother until after she had done it. Her legal name was Hulga. When Mrs. Hopewell thought the name, Hulga, she thought of the broad, blank hull of a battleship. She would not use it. She continued to call her Joy, to which the girl responded, but in a purely mechanical way. Hulga had learned to tolerate Mrs. Freeman, who saved her from taking walks with her mother. Even Glenice and Carame were useful when they occupied attention that might otherwise have been directed at her. At first she had thought she could not stand Mrs. Freeman, for she had found that it was not possible to be rude to her. Mrs. Freeman would take on strange resentments, and for days together she would be sullen, but the source of her displeasure was always obscure. A direct attack, a positive leer, blatant ugliness to her face, these never touched her. and without warning one day, she began calling her Hulga. She did not call her that in front of Mrs. Hopewell, who would have been incensed, but when she and the girl happened to be out of the house together, she would say something and add the name Hulga to the end of it. And the big, spectacled Joy Hulga would scowl and redden, as if her privacy had been intruded upon. She considered the name her personal affair. She had arrived at it first purely on the basis of its ugly sound, and then the full genius of its fitness had struck her. She had a vision of the name working like the ugly, sweating Vulcan, who stayed in the furnace and to whom, presumably, the goddess had to come when called. She saw it as the name of her highest creative act. One of her major triumphs was that her mother had not been able to turn her dust into joy. But the greater one was that she had been able to turn it herself into Hulga. However, Mrs. Freeman's relish for using the name only irritated her. It was as if Mrs. Freeman's beady, steely-pointed eyes had penetrated far enough behind her face to reach some secret fact. Something about her seemed to fascinate Mrs. Freeman, and then one day Hulga realized that it was the artificial leg. Mrs. Freeman had a special fondness for the details of secret infections, hidden deformities, assaults upon children. Of diseases, she preferred the lingering or incurable. Hulga had heard Mrs. Hopewell give her the details of the hunting accident, how the leg had been literally blasted off, how she had never lost consciousness. Mrs. Freeman could listen to it any time as if it had happened an hour ago. When Hulga stumped into the kitchen in the morning, she could walk without making the awful noise, but she made it, Mrs. Hopewell was certain, because it was ugly sounding. She glanced at them and did not speak. Mrs. Hopewell would be in her red kimono with her hair tied around her head in rags. She would be sitting at the table, finishing her breakfast, and Mrs. Freeman would be hanging by her elbow outward from the refrigerator, looking down at the table. Hulga always put her eggs on the stove to boil and then stood over them with her arms folded, and Mrs. Hopewell would look at her, a kind of indirect gaze divided between her and Mrs. Freeman, and would think that if she would only keep herself up a little, she wouldn't be so bad-looking. There was nothing wrong with her face, that a pleasant expression wouldn't help. Mrs. Hopewell said that people who looked on the bright side of things would be beautiful even if they were not. Whenever she looked at Joy this way, she could not help but feel that it would have been better if the child had not taken the Ph.D. It had certainly not brought her out any, and now that she had it, there was no more excuse for her to go to school again. Mrs. Hopewell thought it was nice for girls to go to school to have a good time, but Joy had gone through. Anyhow, she would not have been strong enough to go again. The doctors had told Mrs. Hopewell that with the best of care, Joy might see 45. She had a weak heart. Joy had made it plain that if it had not been for this condition, she would be far from these red hills and good country people. She would be in a university lecturing to people who knew what she was talking about. And Mrs. Hopewell could very well picture her there, looking like a scarecrow and lecturing to more of the same. Here she went about all day in a 6-year-old skirt and a yellow sweatshirt with a faded cowboy on a horse embossed on it. She thought this was funny. Mrs. Hopewell thought it was idiotic and showed simply that she was still a child. She was brilliant, but she didn't have a grain of sense. It seemed to Mrs. Hopewell that every year she grew less like other people and more like herself, bloated, rude, and squint-eyed. And she said such strange things. To her own mother she had said, without warning, without excuse, standing up in the middle of a meal with her face purple and her mouth half full, "Woman, do you ever look inside? Do you ever look inside and see what you are not? God!" she had cried, sinking down again and staring at her plate. "Malebranche was right. We are not our own light. We are not our own light." Mrs. Hopewell had no idea to this day what brought that on. She had only made the remark, hoping Joy would take it in, that a smile never hurt anyone. The girl had taken the Ph.D. in philosophy, and this left Mrs. Hopewell at a complete loss. You could say, my daughter is a nurse, or my daughter is a school teacher, or even my daughter is a chemical engineer. You could not say, my daughter is a philosopher. That was something that had ended with the Greeks and Romans. All day Joyce sat on her neck in a deep chair reading. Sometimes she went for walks, but she didn't like dogs or cats or birds or flowers or nature or nice young men. She looked at nice young men as if she could smell their stupidity. One day Mrs. Hopewell had picked up one of the books the girl had just put down, and opening it at random, she read, "Science, on the other hand, has to assert its soberness and seriousness afresh, and declare that it is concerned solely with what is, nothing. How can it be for science anything but a horror and a phantasm? If science is right, then one thing stands firm. Science wishes to know nothing of nothing, such is, after all, the strictly scientific approach to nothing. We know it by wishing to know nothing of nothing." These words had been underlined with a blue pencil, and they worked on Mrs. Hopewell like some evil incantation in gibberish. She shut the book quickly and went out of the room as if she were having a chill. This morning, when the girl came in, Mrs. Freeman was on Caramé. "She'd thrown up 4 times after supper," she said, "and was up twice in the night after 3 o'clock. Yesterday, she didn't do nothing but ramble in the bureau drawer. All she did, stand up there and see what she could run up on." "She's got to eat," Mrs. Hopewell muttered, sipping her coffee, while she watched Joy's back at the stove. She was wondering what the child had said to the Bible salesman. She could not imagine what kind of a conversation she could possibly have had with him. He was a tall, gaunt, hatless youth who had called yesterday to sell them a Bible. He had appeared at the door, carrying a large black suitcase that weighted him so heavily on one side that he had to brace himself against the door facing. He seemed on the point of collapse, but he said in a cheerful voice, "Good morning, Mrs. Cedars," and set the suitcase down on the mat. He was not a bad-looking young man, though he had on a bright blue suit and yellow socks that were not pulled up far enough. He had prominent face bones and a streak of sticky-looking brown hair falling across his forehead. "I'm Mrs. Hopewell," she said.
"Oh,"
he said, pretending to look puzzled but with his eyes sparkling.
"I saw it said the Cedars on the mailbox, so I thought you was Mrs. Cedars."
And he burst out in a pleasant laugh. He picked up the satchel, and under cover of a pant, he fell forward into her hall. It was rather as if the suitcase had moved first, jerking him after it.
"Mrs. Hopewell," he said, and grabbed her hand. "I hope you are well."
And he laughed again, and then all at once his face sobered completely. He paused and gave her a straight, earnest look and said,
"Lady, I've come to speak of serious things."
"Well, come in," she muttered, none too pleased because her dinner was almost ready. He came into the parlor and sat down on the edge of a straight chair and put the suitcase between his feet and glanced around the room as if he were sizing her up by it. Her silver gleamed on the 2 sideboards. She decided he had never been in a room as elegant as this.
"Mrs. Hopewell,"
he began, using her name in a way that sounded almost intimate.
"I know you believe in Christian service."
"Well, yes," she murmured.
"I know,"
he said, and paused, looking very wise with his head cocked on one side,
"that you're a good woman. Friends have told me."
Mrs. Hopewell never liked to be taken for a fool. "What are you selling?" she asked.
"Bibles,"
the young man said, and his eye raced around the room before he added,
"I see you have no family Bible in your parlor. I see that is the one lack you got."
Mrs. Hopewell could not say, "My daughter is an atheist and won't let me keep the Bible in the parlor." She said, stiffening slightly, "I keep my Bible by my bedside." This was not the truth. It was in the attic somewhere.
"Lady," he said, "the word of God ought to be in the parlor." Well, I think that's a matter of taste, she began. I think,
lady, he said, for a Christian, the word of God ought to be in every room in the house besides in his heart. I know you're a Christian because I can see it in every line of your face.
She stood up and said, well, young man, I don't want to buy a Bible, and I smell my dinner burning. He didn't get up. He began to twist his hands, and looking down at them, he said softly,
well, lady, I'll tell you the truth. Not many people want to buy one nowadays, and besides, I know I'm real simple. I don't know how to say a thing but to say it. I'm just a country boy. He glanced up into her unfriendly face. People like you don't like to fool with country people like me.
Why, she cried, good country people are the salt of the earth. Besides, we all have different ways of doing. It takes all kinds to make the world go round. That's life.
You said a mouthful, he said.
Well, I think there aren't enough good country people in the world, she said, stirred. I think that's what's wrong with it.
His face had brightened. I didn't introduce myself, he said.
I'm Manly Pointer from out in the country around Willoughby. Not even from a place, just from near a place.
You wait a minute, she said. I have to see about my dinner. She went out to the kitchen and found Joy standing near the door where she had been listening.
Get rid of the salt of the earth, she said, and let's eat.
Mrs. Hopewell gave her a pained look and turned the heat down under the vegetables.
I can't be rude to anybody, she murmured,
and went back into the parlor. He had opened the suitcase and was sitting with a Bible on each knee.
You might as well put those up, she told him. I don't want one.
I appreciate your honesty, he said. You don't see any more real honest people unless you go way out in the country.
I know, she said. Real, genuine folks.
Through the crack in the door, she heard a groan.
I guess a lot of boys come telling you they're working their way through college, he said, but I'm not going to tell you that. Somehow, he said, I don't want to go to college. I want to devote my life to Christian service. See, he said, lowering his voice, I got this heart condition. I may not live long. When you know it's something wrong with you and you may not live long, well, then, lady,
he paused with his mouth open and stared at her. He and Joy had the same condition. She knew that her eyes were filling with tears, but she collected herself quickly and murmured,
won't you stay for dinner? We'd love to have you.
And was sorry the instant she heard herself say it.
Yes, ma'am, he said in an abashed voice. I would sure love to do that.
Joy had given him one look on being introduced to him, and then throughout the meal had not glanced at him again. He had addressed several remarks to her, which she had pretended not to hear. Mrs. Hopewell could not understand deliberate rudeness, although she lived with it, and she felt she had always to overflow with hospitality to make up for Joy's lack of courtesy. She urged him to talk about himself, and he did. He said he was the 7th child of 12, and that his father had been crushed under a tree when he himself was 8 years old. He had been crushed very badly, in fact, almost cut in two, and was practically not recognizable. His mother had got along the best she could by hard working, and she had always seen that her children went to Sunday school, and that they read the Bible every evening. He was now 19 years old, and he had been selling Bibles for 4 months. In that time, he had sold 77 Bibles and had the promise of 2 more sales.
He wanted to become a missionary because he thought that was the way you could do most for people.
He who loses his life shall find it, he said simply, and he was so sincere, so genuine and earnest that Mrs. Hopewell would not for the world have smiled. He prevented his peas from sliding onto the table by blocking them with a piece of bread, which he later cleaned his plate with. She could see Joy observing sidewise how he handled his knife and fork, and she saw, too, that every few minutes the boy would dart a keen, appraising glance at the girl,
as if he were trying to attract her attention. After dinner, Joy cleared the dishes off the table and disappeared, and Mrs. Hopewell was left to talk with him. He told her again about his childhood and his father's accident, and about various things that had happened to him. Every 5 minutes or so, she would stifle a yawn. He sat for 2 hours until finally she told him she must go because she had an appointment in town. He packed his Bibles and thanked her and prepared to leave, but in the doorway he stopped and wrung her hand and said that not on any of his trips had he met a lady as nice as her, and he asked if he could come again. She had said she would always be happy to see him. Joy had been standing in the road, apparently looking at something in the distance, when he came down the steps toward her, bent to the side with his heavy valise. He stopped where she was standing and confronted her directly. Mrs. Hopewell could not hear what he said, but she trembled to think what Joy would say to him. She could see that after a minute Joy said something, and that then the boy began to speak again, making an excited gesture with his free hand. After a minute Joy said something else, at which the boy began to speak once more. Then, to her amazement, Mrs. Hopewell saw the two of them walk off together toward the gate. Joy had walked all the way to the gate with him, and Mrs. Hopewell could not imagine what they had said to each other, and she had not yet dared to ask. Mrs. Freeman was insisting upon her attention. She had moved from the refrigerator to the heater so that Mrs. Hopewell had to turn and face her in order to seem to be listening. "Glynis gone out with Harvey Hill again last night," she said. "She had this sty." "Hill," Mrs. Hopewell said absently. "Is that the one who works in the garage?" "No, he's the one that goes to chiropractor school," Mrs. Freeman said. "She had this sty. Been had it 2 days. So she says when he brought her in the other night, he says, 'Let me get rid of that sty for you.' And she says, 'How?' And he says, 'You just lay yourself down across the seat of that car, and I'll show you.' She done it, and he popped her neck. Kept on a-popping it several times until she made him quit. 'This morning,' Mrs. Freeman said, 'she ain't got no sty. She ain't got no traces of a sty.'"
"I never heard of that before," Mrs. Hopewell said.
"He asked her to marry him before the ordinary," Mrs. Freeman went on, "and she told him she wasn't going to be married in no office."
"Well, Glynis is a fine girl," Mrs. Hopewell said. "Glynis and Carame are both fine girls."
"Carame said when her and Lyman was married, Lyman said it sure felt sacred to him. She said he said he wouldn't take $500 for being married by a preacher."
"How much would he take?" the girl asked from the stove.
"He said he wouldn't take $500, Mrs. Freeman repeated. "Well, we all have work to do," Mrs. Hopewell said.
"Lyman said it just felt more sacred to him," Mrs. Freeman said.
"The doctor wants Carame to eat prunes, says instead of medicine. Says them cramps is coming from pressure. You know where I think it is?"
"She'll be better in a few weeks," Mrs. Hopewell said.
"In the tube," Mrs. Freeman said. "Else she wouldn't be as sick as she is."
Holga had cracked her 2 eggs into a saucer and was bringing them to the table along with a cup of coffee that she had filled too full. She sat down carefully and began to eat, meaning to keep Mrs. Freeman there by questions if for any reason she showed an inclination to leave. She could perceive her mother's eye on her. The first roundabout question would be about the Bible salesman, and she did not wish to bring it on.
"How did he pop her neck?" she asked.
Mrs. Freeman went into a description of how he had popped her neck. She said he owned a 55 Mercury, but the Glynis said she would rather marry a man with only a 36 Plymouth, who would be married by a preacher. The girl asked, "What if he had a 32 Plymouth?" And Mrs. Freeman said what Glynis had said was a 36 Plymouth. Mrs. Hopewell said there were not many girls with Glynis's common sense. She said what she admired in those girls was their common sense. She said that reminded her that they had had a nice visitor yesterday, a young man selling Bibles.
"Lord," she said, "he bored me to death, but he was so sincere and genuine I couldn't be rude to him. He was just good country people, you know, she said. Just the salt of the earth.
I seen him walk up, Mrs. Freeman said. And then later, I seen him walk off.
And Holga could feel the slight shift in her voice, the slight insinuation, that he had not walked off alone, had he? Her face remained expressionless, but the color rose into her neck, and she seemed to swallow it down with the next spoonful of egg. Mrs. Freeman was looking at her as if they had a secret together.
Well, it takes all kinds of people to make the world go round, Mrs. Hopewell said. It's very good we aren't all alike.
Some people are more alike than others, Mrs. Freeman said.
Holga got up and stumped, with about twice the noise that was necessary, into her room and locked the door. She was to meet the Bible salesman at 10 o'clock at the gate. She had thought about it half the night. She had started thinking of it as a great joke, and then she had begun to see profound implications in it. She had lain in bed imagining dialogues for them that were insane on the surface, but that reached below the depths that no Bible salesman would be aware of. Their conversation yesterday had been of this kind. He had stopped in front of her and had simply stood there. His face was bony and sweaty and bright, with a little pointed nose in the center of it, and his look was different from what it had been at the dinner table. He was gazing at her with open curiosity, with fascination, like a child watching a new fantastic animal at the zoo, and he was breathing as if he had run a great distance to reach her. His gaze seemed somehow familiar, but she could not think where she had been regarded with it before. For almost a minute, he didn't say anything. Then, on what seemed an insuck of breath, he whispered, "You ever ate a chicken that was 2 days old?" The girl looked at him stonily. He might have just put this question up for consideration at the meeting of a philosophical association.
"Yes," she presently replied, as if she had considered it from all angles. "It must have been mighty small," he said triumphantly, and shook all over with little nervous giggles, getting very red in the face, and subsiding finally into his gaze of complete admiration, while the girl's expression remained exactly the same.
"How old are you?"
he asked softly. She waited some time before she answered. Then in a flat voice she said,
17.
His smiles came in succession like waves breaking on the surface of a little lake.
"I see you got a wooden leg," he said. "I think you're real brave. I think you're real sweet."
The girl stood blank and solid and silent.
"Walk to the gate with me," he said. "You're a brave, sweet little thing, and I liked you the minute I seen you walk in the door."
Holga began to move forward.
"What's your name?"
he asked, smiling down on the top of her head.
"Holga,"
she said.
"Holga,"
he murmured.
"Holga, Holga. I never heard of anybody named Holga before. You're shy, aren't you, Holga?"
he asked. She nodded, watching his large red hand on the handle of the giant valise.
"I like girls that wear glasses," he said. "I think a lot. I'm not like these people that a serious thought don't ever enter their heads. It's because I may die."
"I may die too," she said suddenly, and looked up at him.
His eyes were very small and brown, glittering feverishly.
"Listen," he said. "Don't you think some people was meant to meet on account of what all they got in common and all? Like they both think serious thoughts and all?"
He shifted the valise to his other hand, so that the hand nearest her was free. He caught hold of her elbow and shook it a little.
"I don't work on Saturday," he said. "I like to walk in the woods and see what Mother Nature is wearing. Over the hills and far away. Picnics and things. Couldn't we go on a picnic tomorrow? Say yes, Holga,"
he said, and gave her a dying look as if he felt his insides about to drop out of him. He had even seemed to sway slightly toward her. During the night she had imagined that she seduced him. She imagined that the two of them walked on the place until they came to the storage barn, beyond the two backfields, and there, she imagined,
that things came to such a pass that she very easily seduced him, and that then, of course, she had to reckon with his remorse. True genius can get an idea across even to an inferior mind. She imagined that she took his remorse in hand and changed it into a deeper understanding of life. She took all his shame away and turned it into something useful. She set off for the gate at exactly 10 o'clock, escaping without drawing Mrs. Hopewell's attention. She didn't take anything to eat, forgetting that food is usually taken on a picnic. She wore a pair of slacks and a dirty white shirt, and, as an afterthought, she had put some Vapex on the collar of it, since she did not own any perfume. When she reached the gate, no one was there. She looked up and down the empty highway, and had the furious feeling that she had been tricked, that he had only meant to make her walk to the gate after the idea of him. Then suddenly he stood up, very tall, from behind a bush on the opposite embankment. Smiling, he lifted his hat, which was new and wide-brimmed. He had not worn it yesterday, and she wondered if he had bought it for the occasion. It was toast-colored with a red and white band around it, and was slightly too large for him. He stepped from behind the bush, still carrying the black valise. He had on the same suit and the same yellow socks sucked down in his shoes from walking. He crossed the highway and said, "I knew you'd come." The girl wondered acidly how he had known this. She pointed to the valise and asked, "Why did you bring your Bibles?" He took her elbow, smiling down on her as if he could not stop.
"You can never tell when you'll need the word of God, Hulga," he said.
She had a moment in which she doubted that this was actually happening, and then they began to climb the embankment. They went down into the pasture toward the woods. The boy walked lightly by her side, bouncing on his toes. The valise did not seem to be heavy today. He even swung it. They crossed half the pasture without saying anything, and then, putting his hand easily on the small of her back, he asked softly,
"Where does your wooden leg join on?"
She turned an ugly red and glared at him, and for an instant the boy looked abashed.
"I didn't mean you no harm," he said. "I only meant you're so brave and all. I guess God takes care of you."
"No," she said, looking forward and walking fast. "I don't even believe in God." At this he stopped and whistled.
"No!"
he exclaimed, as if he were too astonished to say anything else. She walked on, and in a second he was bouncing at her side, fanning with his hat.
"That's very unusual for a girl," he remarked, watching her out of the corner of his eye.
When they reached the edge of the wood, he put his hand on her back again, and drew her against him without a word, and kissed her heavily. The kiss, which had more pressure than feeling behind it, produced that extra surge of adrenaline in the girl that enables one to carry a packed trunk out of a burning house. But in her, the power went at once to the brain. Even before he released her, her mind, clear and detached and ironic anyway, was regarding him from a great distance, with amusement, but with pity. She had never been kissed before, and she was pleased to discover that it was an unexceptional experience, and all a matter of the mind's control. Some people might enjoy drain water if they were told it was vodka. When the boy, looking expectant but uncertain, pushed her gently away, she turned and walked on, saying nothing as if such business, for her, were common enough. He came along, panting at her side, trying to help her when he saw a root that she might trip over. He caught and held back the long, swaying blades of thorn vine until she had passed beyond them. She led the way, and he came breathing heavily behind her. Then they came out on a sunlit hillside, sloping softly into another one a little smaller. Beyond, they could see the rusted top of the old barn where the extra hay was stored. The hill was sprinkled with small pink weeds.
"Then you ain't saved?" he asked suddenly, stopping.
The girl smiled. It was the first time she had smiled at him at all. "In my economy," She said, I'm saved and you are damned. But I told you I didn't believe in God. Nothing seemed to destroy the boy's look of admiration. He gazed at her now as if the fantastic animal at the zoo had put its paw through the bars and given him a loving poke. She thought he looked as if he wanted to kiss her again, and she walked on before he had the chance. "Ain't there somewheres we can sit down sometime?" he murmured, his voice softening toward the end of the sentence. "In that barn," she said. They made for it rapidly as if it might slide away like a train. It was a large two-story barn, cool and dark inside. The boy pointed up the ladder that led into the loft and said, "It's too bad we can't go up there." "Why can't we?" she asked. "Your leg," he said reverently. The girl gave him a contemptuous look, and putting both hands on the ladder, she climbed it while he stood below, apparently awestruck. She pulled herself expertly through the opening and then looked down at him and said, "Well, come on, if you're coming." And he began to climb the ladder, awkwardly bringing the suitcase with him. "We won't need the Bible," she observed.
"You never can tell," he said, panting.
After he had got into the loft, he was a few seconds catching his breath. She had sat down in a pile of straw. A wide sheath of sunlight, filled with dust particles, slanted over her. She lay back against a bale, her face turned away, looking out the front opening of the barn where hay was thrown from a wagon into the loft. The two pink-speckled hillsides lay back against a dark ridge of woods. The sky was cloudless and cold blue. The boy dropped down by her side and put one arm under her and the other over her, and began methodically kissing her face, making little noises like a fish. He did not remove his hat, but it was pushed far enough back not to interfere. When her glasses got in his way, he took them off of her and slipped them into his pocket. The girl at first did not return any of the kisses, but presently she began to, and after she had put several on his cheek, she reached his lips and remained there, kissing him again and again, as if she were trying to draw all the breath out of him. His breath was clear and sweet like a child's, and the kisses were sticky like a child's. He mumbled about loving her and about knowing when he first seen her that he loved her, but the mumbling was like the sleepy fretting of a child being put to sleep by his mother. Her mind throughout this never stopped or lost itself for a second to her feelings.
"You ain't said you loved me none,"
he whispered finally, pulling back from her.
"You gotta say that."
She looked away from him off into the hollow sky, and then down at a black ridge, and then down farther into what appeared to be two green-swelling lakes. She didn't realize he had taken her glasses, but this landscape could not seem exceptional to her, for she seldom paid any close attention to her surroundings.
"You gotta say it," he repeated. "You got to say you love me."
She was always careful how she committed herself. "In a sense," she began, "if you use the word loosely, you might say that. But it's not a word I use. I don't have illusions. I'm one of those people who see through to nothing." The boy was frowning.
"You gotta say it. I said it, and you gotta say it," he said.
The girl looked at him almost tenderly. "You poor baby," she murmured. "It's just as well you don't understand." And she pulled him by the neck, face down against her. "We are all damned."